when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Oxio. They provide internet. I don't think I need to sell you on internet. You just need internet. The only decision to make is whether you want it from somebody who you hate passionately, which are most of the options on the market, or Oxio. They do not jack up your fees without telling you. They don't do shady, slimy things. They're just there giving you internet. Visit canadaland.oxio.ca for an alternative telco internet experience. That's OXIO.ca. Use the promo code CanadaLand. That'll get you your first month for free. This episode is brought to you by Douglas. If you know of a better Canadian mattress at a better price point, well, you're just a liar and you're lying to me right now. No, Douglas is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. I know this mattress. I trust this mattress. Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That's douglas.ca/CanadaLand.
Iran vows to avenge the deaths of several officials killed by an Israeli attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria.
Explosions lit up Israel's night sky as interceptors took down dozens upon dozens of Iranian-launched drones.
Concerns this morning after Israel's apparent attack on Iranian soil.
These people wandering around Toronto's Pearson Airport got a tip about a passenger on an incoming flight. Someone from Iran. Reportedly someone close to the murderous regime. Someone may be hoping to slip in unnoticed.
Why are you coming here? You are working for the Iranian regime.
The leader of the opposition has been vocal about getting tough with the Islamic Republic.
To think that we might have terrorist-linked Iranian regime thugs operating with impunity, spending stolen money, and intimidating Canadian Jews and Iranians is appalling.
Canadian media coverage of the war in the Middle East has, unsurprisingly, focused on the impact on diaspora communities here in Canada. This includes Canada Land's own coverage. We have heard about Jewish Canadians. We have heard about Palestinian Canadians. We have heard in general terms about the many Muslim communities across Canada and how this is all affecting them. But there's one diaspora community that is increasingly at the center of this conflict who we have heard very little about, and that is the Iranian community. Canada is home to the second largest Iranian diaspora community in the world. There are 400,000. So what are they going through? On the one hand, the answer to that question is probably that they're going through the same thing that the rest of us are going through. Diaspora communities have a few things in common. We're feeling this in multiple ways. For those of us who have family and friends who live in countries that are under attack, we're just afraid for people's safety and well-being. Meanwhile, diaspora communities in Canada are also concerned about ourselves, how our families and neighbors and ourselves right here in Canada are being increasingly targeted in an increasingly angry, vitriolic conflict. There is also, for all of these communities internal divisions here in Canada. The arguments and fighting and dinner table conversations have been hard. And then, of course, all of these communities are impacted in the way that everybody is impacted, watching on as the death count overseas grows. So how is this conflict affecting Iranian Canadians? In all of those ways, it will come as no surprise. But there are some specifics about this community that have gone unexamined. We have heard that all of this stems from a shadow war that has been going on for years between Israel and Iran. We have heard, and it has been documented, that Iran has been funding Hamas and Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Houthis in Yemen. Now that shadow war has been dragged out into the daylight, and there are open hostilities between Israel and Iran. Perhaps they are over, perhaps they are not. All of this just increases the pressure on this one community that we have not really heard that much about, which is not to say that they have not been active. Iranian Canadians have been incredibly visible and active and outspoken during this conflict. There has been a presence of Iranian Canadians at pro-Israel rallies. There have been Iranian Canadian speakers speaking in support of Israel at many of these rallies. And some of the leading voices on the pro-Palestinian side have been the voices of Iranian Canadians. Now listen, I do not know much about the Persian diaspora, but what I do know is that this community is complex. And no one person can represent an entire community. None of the people that I'm going to speak to today claim to represent the community. But we have found three people among the Persian diaspora here in Canada. Three people who have all been very vocal about the conflict in the Middle East. And three people with very different points of view about the conflict in the Middle East. And a lot of knowledge about what Iranian Canadians are going through. In a minute, they're going to sit down with me to try to take me through these dynamics and to get through some of the issues that they have with each other. Samira Mohayeddin is a journalist and radio host. She's worked as a producer at CBC's The Current, and she hosted the CBC food and culture show Unforked. Kaveh Shirouz is a lawyer, human rights activist, and senior fellow at the MacDonald Laurier Institute. Earlier this year, he launched a campaign to run for federal office. He wanted to be the conservative candidate for Richmond Hill, but he withdrew from that race, claiming foreign interference into his campaign from the Islamic regime of Iran. Finally, Amir Atran is a professor in both the Faculty of Law and the School of Epidemiology, Public Health, and Community Medicine at the University of Ottawa. He writes about public health and global development issues. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Adam Langille, Jonathan Foreman, Jesse McIntyre, Lachlan McDonald, James Roberts, Brian Parker, Joey Huggins, and Natalie.
My name's Natalie, and I'm a nurse practitioner working with vulnerable populations in Toronto. I support Canada Land because for so long, I lamented that I couldn't find a Canadian perspective on politics, the media, and popular culture. Now, Canada Land does that for me perfectly, every week. I'm really looking forward to the new season of Commons, and thanks, Canada Land, for all your great work.
I'm Amir Adaran. I'm a law professor at the University of Ottawa.
My name is Samira Moyadin. I'm a journalist based in Toronto.
And I'm Kaveh Shirouz. I'm a lawyer and a human rights activist.
Canadian coverage of the conflict has focused on our diaspora community. Specifically, we've heard about the Canadian Jewish community and how they're experiencing things, the Canadian Palestinian community, and there's been coverage generally of Muslim communities. We have not heard much about what is happening with the Canadian-Iranian community specifically. Recognizing that none of you can speak for an entire community and none of you would do so, but we've asked you to join us today because each of you does have a different perspective, an informed perspective on how this is impacting Iranian Canadians. And I'm wondering if you could each kind of take a whack at orienting me a little bit. Like, what is the atmosphere like, if it can be described succinctly?
I think it depends. I think the conversations around dinner tables are different than the conversations that are being had in boardrooms and newsrooms, et cetera. I mean, I'm speaking mainly for myself, but the Iranian diaspora is very much impacted by this because you can't almost talk about what's going on in Israel-Palestine without discussing Iran, whether it's their involvement in this or how the government in Iran takes up Palestine and wears it as a sort of badge of honor, as a sort of we're the only ones who support the Palestinians. And you're also seeing people in the diaspora who, like the hashtag Iranians stand with Israel was trending on Twitter. I've gone to protests in Toronto where you see the three same Iranians in diaspora, you know, coming in the middle, basically acting like agent provocateurs, inciting people to react to them. They're wearing Israeli flags, also wearing the, you know, lion and sun flag. And if you go back to the sort of dining tables and in people's kitchens, I know of major conflicts going on within families, and particularly among sort of younger Iranians versus their parents' generation, who right now, because you have a government that sort of takes on Palestine the way it does, there is a large group of people who, whatever the Iranian government says, they will do the total opposite. So even if, let's say, the Iranian government says it's sunny out, and it is sunny, people will say, no, it isn't, it's raining. Iranians have been lied to for so long by this regime that they can't even believe something when it is true, right? So I think that, I mean, there's a lot of tension in the community, and I don't think it's going to be going away anytime soon.
Kaveh?
Well, first of all, I think there's two separate issues at play. One is the prospect of war with Iran. So that's one debate. And I mean, these two debates are related, but one debate is about the prospect of Israeli-American war with Iran. And then the second discussion is around how people feel about the Israel-Palestine conflict. On the Israel-Palestine conflict, you know, I agree with Samira. I think there is a fair degree of tension. What's interesting to me is that, you know, this is not the first time Israel has had conflicts with the Palestinians. And I think about what the reaction in my own circles, in my own community has been, you know, in the past decade or last 15 years or so. And I would say 15 years ago, 10 years ago, there would have been much more of a knee-jerk sentiment in favor of the Palestinians. I'm seeing that less now among, you know, my circle and what I see online. Obviously, a lot of this is self-selection and, you know, selection bias and so on. But I think a lot of Iranians in the diaspora recognize that we and the Israelis have a common enemy in Hamas. They see in Hamas something that reminds them a lot of the regime that they escaped. They agree that with the Israelis that you know, Hamas has to be eradicated. I have certainly, you know, just personally, my views have certainly shifted over the past decade. I think probably 10 years ago I would have been much more sympathetic to the Palestinian cause in a way that I'm not now. I don't think I'm much outside the mainstream based on kind of what I'm seeing. I think there is much more sympathy towards the Israeli cause than there was maybe a decade ago.
Amir, what do you think about what you're hearing so far? Does this match your understanding of things?
No, it really doesn't. I think Iranians are no smarter than anyone else. Let's stipulate that at the outset. Being Iranian is not some sort of intellectual superpower. And what that means is Iranians can get played the same way as anyone else. And they are being played in this conflict because they do enact these knee-jerk positions that you've just heard about. What Iranians are overlooking very much is that Iran, in a sense, needs conflict with Israel as much as Israel needs conflict with Iran right now. The Iranian regime is very unpopular. So is Netanyahu's regime. The pair of them are jackasses. Let's just be clear, right? Who don't have popular support, who are, by any ruse available to them, trying to maintain power. And to the extent that they can stoke tensions with one another, those regimes gain a sense of necessity or inevitability. And we've seen that in how Israelis have rallied a little bit to Netanyahu since the belligerent exchanges a couple weeks ago. And there's been some of that in Iran as well. These are two forces, and the regimes need each other. in a state of conflict in order to rally their people and gain what little legitimacy they can obtain.
I just want to pick up on something Amir said that I think is important to note when he said that Iranians are being played. Iranians, in a way, are being played because when Netanyahu sits and says, I will help you get your freedom to Iranians, it's really absurd. You know, he does have a captive audience in Iran. I look at the commentary under things that are put out by Iranian diaspora channels. The commentary under those videos coming out of Iran is very pro-Israeli. But again, those are people in that silo. So it's hard to make, I think, sweeping judgments. One of the things that I think is really important to note is, again, the understanding that as a kid in Iran, you're taught since primary school to say death to Israel, death to America. That's something that you're just brought up with, right? Two things happen to you. Either you go home and your parents tell you, you know, those things are just things you're taught, you're not supposed to do that, or you really take that on. And then what we're seeing in Iran is a real backlash towards this. Right? We're seeing younger kids, especially Gen Z, not stepping on the Israeli flag as they enter into school, not stepping on the American flag as they enter into their schools. Even though we may see what Israel's nefarious policies in the subjugation of Palestinians is, there are people who will go against that just to go against the regime.
My understanding of what I'm being told is that in trying to understand Iranian Canadians, those of them who support Israel and who are showing up at these protests, what you are suggesting is that this is not so much to do with these people of their own volition, of their own interests, and of their own opinions saying, you know what, I support Israel, but in fact, they are coming from either a country or a culture that has rammed hatred of Israel down their throats, and in rejecting the regime, that is why they embrace Israel. And furthermore, you're suggesting that they are being played, as Amir put it, manipulated, Samira, by an obsession from the IDF and from Israel, who are targeting the Iranian diaspora and trying to turn their hearts and minds against the regime for their own cynical benefit. Now, I'm generally inclined to accept in good faith that when somebody shows up in a protest and says that they believe in something, they believe in it. Kaveh, what do you make of this description of why we are seeing the presence of Iranian Canadians at these protests?
There's three of them, by the way. Let's just make that very clear. I can name all three of them.
I'm not talking about any individual person. I mean, there are particular people that have extremist views that show up at these rallies that I think maybe the people Samira is alluding to. I don't want to talk about individuals. What I'll say, though, is that I disagree with the characterization of Iranians as being played. I think, frankly, that's a little bit of a condescending view. Certainly, you know, Israel, just like many other countries, tries to get its message out to various audiences. You can call that propaganda. That's why I think every government engages in it. But I think Iranians have come over the past 40 years to kind of better understand what their own interests are. And I think what you're beginning to see is them actually rejecting, I mean, talk about being played is exactly the kind of stuff that Samira was describing. You know, from the cradle, you're taught, you know, death to Israel, death to America. You've got a captive audience in Iran at the schools, you know, through media, you're constantly taught this. And Iranians, a lot of them, especially in the diaspora, are waking up and saying, no, we reject this. I refuse to categorize that as being played. I view that as actually recognizing who your oppressor is. They recognize that the Islamic Republic and by extension Hamas and groups like that are their oppressors. And they're recognizing that they have a common cause in many ways with the Israelis.
What it seems like the disagreement, and I'm getting a sense maybe of what some dinner table disagreements have been like, is not so much pro-regime, anti-regime. It's what is the best form of resistance to the regime.
Can I just jump in with something?
Yeah.
You say that no one's pro-regime. And by and large, nobody comes out and says, I am pro-regime. But what I will say is that this attitude of the Iranian regime is just like the Israeli government. To me, that is tantamount to supporting the Iranian regime. That moral equivalence, to me, really downplays the horrendous nature of Iran's regime. So, you know, when I observe the debate, when I see somebody making the argument that Amir made, I see that as tantamount to actually support for Iran's regime.
Hang on.
I think that's a leap because you're talking to people who I think have been forthright and outspoken in their opposition to the regime, right? So it doesn't seem like they're shrugging off I understand that you object to the moral equivalency that you've established.
Absolutely,
that.
But I mean, I think that,
but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're excusing. I mean, if anything, they're explicitly saying is just the opposite.
There's a great deal of whitewashing involved in making that claim.
I got to have a word here because Kaveh totally misrepresented what I said. Kaveh, open your ears, open them good. I never said I support the Iranian regime.
You don't need
regime.
To say that you support them. You just need to downplay the horrors of living under that regime.
And I didn't minimize that. This conversation will go in a different direction if you start putting words in my mouth. Let's not go there. What I am making clear to everybody, including particularly yourself, is that there is a certain objective equivalence, speaking as a law professor, between Iran and Israel. They both engage in frequent violations of the laws of war. They both have poor regard for human rights. These are objective facts.
These are not objective facts. I'm sorry, they're simply not objective facts. They're simply not.
They're not.
The behavior of Iran's regime.
You're a fool. I'm going to put it as bluntly as
that. I owe all of you a civil forum here. And Amir, if you're going to speak as a law professor, I think that there's a very real possibility that Israel is going to face legal consequences under the charges of war crimes. But I don't know that that's an established legal fact at this point.
There are well-researched assessments of the human rights situation in Israel and Iran, both from Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the UN Office of the High Commissioner, from the European Union, from the United States. And let's be exquisitely clear, neither country comes across as a star player in human rights.
Samira, you have written in the Globe and Mail that it has become a running joke among Iranians that when the Islamic Republic government falls, half of the officials will make their way to Canada because they already have a Canadian passport. So the idea that Canada is a safe haven for members of the regime is a hard one to comprehend, given that our government has designated the regime a terrorist regime and a human rights violator. So we can talk about how there isn't like any kind of pocket of overt support for the regime, and yet you're telling me that you could like bump into a minister of the Islamic regime at like a restaurant or coffee shop who somehow got into Canada. Can you help us understand how that is the case?
I have a friend who is a professor at York University who 20 years ago was in a documentary, and she talked about seeing her torturer on the TTC, on the subway, and how that just sort of crippled her, like she couldn't move. So one of the things I didn't have space to write about is that this isn't a partisan issue in Canada. The conservatives were using this as a way to sort of bash the Trudeau government to say, look at all the people you're letting in. But this number of these officials coming in was under the conservative government, was under Harper. And whether it was low-level officials or people who were accused of embezzling. And so, you know, the designation that Canada gave only happened after a young woman, Mahsa Amini, was killed.
She was arrested and killed by Iran back in September 2022.
Mahsa Amini was a 22-year-old girl who was visiting the capital, Tehran. And on September 13th, she was confronted by the so-called morality police for being allegedly dressed inappropriately. So she was taken to a police station for what the authorities called so-called re-education of why the hijab is mandatory in Iran. The authorities said that she had suffered a heart attack and died. Her family are saying a very different story, that she had suffered abuse at the hands of the police when she was in their custody.
They didn't do it when Zahra Kazemi was murdered and tortured in Iran, a Canadian citizen who was arrested in 2003. So more than 20 years ago, she was tortured, brutally raped and murdered by the Iranian regime, who denied doing that to her, you know, very much in the same way they denied killing Mahsa Amini. They said that she fell down, bumped her head. And it wasn't until years later that a doctor who actually admitted her into that hospital said there was bruising all over her body and signs of a brutal rape, torture, murder. And all Canada did in that respect was recall their ambassador. They didn't shut down the embassy. It wasn't until a decade later that you saw the Iranian embassy in Ottawa shut down. Some of the Iranians that I've spoken to in diaspora really lament the fact that the Canadian government really started going against Iran really hard after October 7th. And it was always this sort of, you know, we've been telling you this for so long. You didn't give a shit when they were killing Iranian Canadians, but now you care when Israelis are being massacred. A lot of Iranians are like, we tried to warn you, but you didn't listen.
So this was just a lack of...
I think it's naivete about how easy it is to actually... And, you know, you had right now, one of the people that I wrote about in that Globe and Mail piece was a former interior deputy minister whose job it was basically to deny the killing of more than 1,500 protesters on the streets of Iran in November 2019. It was his job to do that. He made his way here. He was living here.
This episode is brought to you by Article. It is happening. Spring is here. It is very exciting. It never fails to get me very excited. I love to break free of this kind of entombed Canadian indoors experience and hang out on a patio. I care very much about the form factor of a good patio. I care about the furniture, and Article cares too. They believe in delightful design for every home. My whole outdoor setup is Article at this point. It happens slowly. I tried them out. I liked them. And then just piece by piece, that's become my whole game. The whole experience is seamless and pleasant. The stuff is great. It is stylish. And because you listen to this podcast, you have access to a great deal. They're very confident that you're going to feel the way that I do. So Canada Land listeners get $50 off of your first purchase of $100 or more. That can be a 50% discount. To claim this, visit article.com/CanadaLand. The discount will be automatically applied at checkout. That's article.com/CanadaLand for $50 off of your first purchase of $100 or more. This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. Kaveh, you have alleged that there is foreign interference in Canadian politics. When we talk about foreign interference in Canadian politics, the names that come up are China and India. I don't hear so much about Iran, but you withdrew your candidacy alleging that there was foreign interference. So this is just helping informationally to orient listeners here on like what is going on within this community. We don't have a lot of support for the regime, but apparently we have interference from the regime in our domestic politics.
Interference takes many forms. You know, I had a personal encounter with that, and I'm going to be talking about it in the second phase of the foreign interference inquiry. I'm going to be giving testimony there. So the interference takes many forms. Part of it is, as Samira was describing, you know, folks with ties to Iran's regime, security officials, you know, people in the banking sector, whatever, people that have embezzled large amounts of money, people that have ties to the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards, finding their way to Canada, living here in, you know, some of the most expensive mansions in Toronto and Vancouver and elsewhere. And, you know, people that go out and participate in Canadian politics or participate in protests focused on Iran or activism focused on Iran, they're deeply afraid that, you know, they're going to be photographed or, you know, there's going to be a record of their activism that's going to be passed back to the authorities in Iran and they'll be targeted. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is the online manipulation of the discourse that happens. And I think that's actually what I encountered more in my own experience, my own candidacy.
So what happened to you?
I declared that I was going to be seeking the nomination of the Conservative Party in the riding of Richmond Hill, a riding that actually has a significant Iranian-Canadian population. Even before I announced it, there was a concentrated effort to attack me, to defame me, to lie about me, to spread disinformation. And it's not so much, you know, the little bits of disinformation being spread about me. It's the amplification of those lies hundreds of thousands, if not millions of times online that really sort of threw a wrench in the works.
how do you know it was foreign interference?
How do I know? I mean, with a lot of these things, it's almost impossible to prove except when you observe the behavior online. And I've been observing the online behavior of the Iranian regime's so-called cyber army, their bots, for many years. And a lot of what happened appeared to me and many others who observed it as very inorganic. There is no reason why somebody like me, for example, running in a little election in a little 905 riding, their name needs to trend on Twitter, for example, twice in 2 weeks, except through bot manipulation. I was observing some of these accounts that were retweeting and spreading this disinformation.
So in the short time that we've been talking and trying to understand just what are the different opinions, what are the rifts, we've heard that there's an accusation that hearts and minds are being manipulated by the Israeli government, and another accusation that hearts and minds of Canadians are being manipulated by the Iranian regime. There seems to be a great deal of suspicion and fear that things are not what they seem. Is this something that is part of the culture that we're trying to describe here? Is there an atmosphere? And Amira, let me ask you your thoughts on this, of paranoia, maybe even warranted paranoia. Are people afraid of each other?
I think, Jesse, what you've just described, I view as banal. Of course there is Iranian interference with the diaspora here. Of course there is Israeli interference with our government. I mean, my goodness, Israel has flown how many of our MPs to visit Israel? Those are banalities. Those are just the way it is. Does it result in people like Kaveh making different assessments about running for office or not? Well, he says it does, and I believe him. But this is just in the nature of being a multicultural country, as we wonderfully are in Canada, that certain pressures from the quote-unquote old country bear upon us. And I don't think it is realistic to expect that Canada can erect a moat around itself to remain unaffected by Iranian or Israeli or Chinese or Indian or what have you influence. Nor do I expect it to be the case that some people will find it very upsetting, while most of us actually just accept it as a fact of life.
Samira, that's different than what you were saying. You know, to imagine that there's just a certain amount of static that we should just accept and that that's true of any population. And Amira, that does remind me of like some of the shrugging off we heard about the idea of Chinese interference. Well, this is just global politics and countries are going to propagandize and it's nothing to get too concerned about. And then we find out that actually there was transfers of money and there were voters were being bussed in. It actually seems like there was quite a bit more to it.
That's a fair point. And I'm not saying this to excuse illegality. Violations of election laws and such like. No, I'm not saying it to excuse that, but it is a fact of being in a multicultural society that diaspora politics get dragged here from the old country.
And I've read elsewhere about people being afraid of informants or afraid of consequences for their family back in Iran. That is different than the normal status of diaspora politics or old world politics come in. That seems to be a reason to be concerned, cautious, fearful.
It is for people who are actively organizing protests against the regime. And specifically, I'm going to point out the family members of the PS752, the downing of the Ukrainian Airlines plane. Those family members, particularly people who have been organizing and trying to get justice for their family members, they are directly threatened. They receive messages in their WhatsApps. They're followed. I mean, things are happening to them. They're not being paranoid.
Can you remind us briefly of the details of that tragedy?
So on January 8th, 2020, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps shot down a passenger plane. 176 people were on this plane. The plane was leaving Tehran. They denied shooting down the plane for 3 days. Then they fessed up after satellite imagery showed that, in fact, it was you who did it. Two missiles, killing 176 people. 138 of them were on their way to Pearson International in Toronto.
Notably, for the purpose of our conversation, 85 of them were either Canadian citizens or permanent residents in Canada.
Yeah. And so those families have been threatened. But one thing I wanted to pick up on, just in terms of diaspora politics, you mentioned, Jesse, about people not trusting one another. I think it's a fact. I mean, I see it. Iranians don't trust one another. If you're meeting someone that you don't know, you suss them out. You know, where do you stand on this? Where do you stand on that? And you don't really reveal how you feel about certain things. But I think that has to do a lot with people coming from a totalitarian regime. People in Iran don't trust one another either. Like, we have a saying, the walls have mice and the mice have ears. I compare our diaspora a lot to the Cuban diaspora. It's a diaspora that was created out of a revolution. There was no Iranian diaspora before 1979. We are now numbering close to 6 million people around the world. Everyone isn't out looking for a buck or a new life. Like, a lot of people are really just leaving for that basic, you know, we might find it cliche, but freedom. And a lot of them are Muslim. What the regime in Iran has done really effectively is make a huge population secular, and then also make a lot of Muslims not want to practice their religion within that framework that they've set up. It's such a failure of a project, the Islamic Republic. It's a failure in every respect. As a community, we are like any other diaspora community. I mean, you look at the Cubans, right? They're concentrated in Florida. They don't trust one another. Some people are vehemently anti-Castro. They've been living under sanctions exactly the same way the Iranian regime has, to no avail. It has not subdued Iran. It has not made them become less violent. It has not made them become less, you know, totalitarian against their own citizens. Sometimes I think it's important for us to look at ourselves within the scope of other communities and say, we're not that different. We are no different than any other diaspora who's gone through a very traumatic event.
The part that I still don't understand is, it makes sense to me why you would be afraid, if the walls have ears, to have a discussion about politics in Iran. Why would you be afraid of having a conversation like that here? What could the consequences be?
I get frustrated when people say I'm afraid, because a lot of it has to do with being a coward or a comprador. You know, you have business interests back home. I am quite outspoken against the regime. I have a lot of family members who live in the country. I have a lot of family members here who come and go. Nothing has ever happened to them. So I think a lot of people are either cowards or, as I said, they have other interests at heart.
Kava, do you have any thoughts on this?
I wouldn't phrase it that way. I mean, I really do wish more members of our community would display moral courage. I agree with that. But I don't think the risk is nothing. I mean, I think if you're going back and forth to visit elderly parents, for example, or if you've got a business, you've got a small business in Iran or something, I don't think it's unreasonable to worry about that. And that's something that people, just ordinary people, worry about, and it prevents them from coming out, from expressing their views, both with respect to Iran and also in Canadian politics and, you know, supporting politicians that may be against the Islamic regime. I mean, the more extreme cases of it, Samira mentioned, you know, the PS752 families. I work very closely with them. I'm one of their legal advisors. And they deal with real, genuine threats. I mean, you know, one of the main people that's involved in that organization, the Association of the Families, he's spoken up, and his family has actually been detained. His mother has been prevented from leaving the country. Other family members have actually been taken in for questioning. And people genuinely worry that, you know, this is a regime that doesn't care about its reputation, doesn't care what international human rights organizations say or foreign governments say. It will harm your family members for your activities here.
My understanding is that it's gotten worse. There was widespread protest, and we saw briefly, I thought, that there was just like kind of a consensus in the diaspora community because of the sheer numbers of people who were showing up on the streets of Toronto after the regime murdered a woman, as you mentioned earlier, Samira. It seemed like there were global protests, and it seemed like there wasn't a lot of controversy. People were taking to the streets against this regime. Those protests also took place in Iran, and people were in sort of civil disobedience of the enforcement of head coverings, things like that. And I'm reading now that the regime is cracking down. Samira, when you talk about cowardice, the regime, as I understand it, is a brutal regime and will crack down on people and take out vengeance on people's family. That's established fact, yes?
Yeah, but it's precarious, and that's why it's dangerous. You see, because you'd never know what you do that might make you get caught. That's the thing. And that's what really living in a totalitarian system is. You don't know where the red lines are. They can change from day to day. They can change because a certain individual doesn't like the way your jeans are rolled up or you're showing whatever. Like, Mahsa Amini was covered. We have to be very specific about that too. She was not wearing something that was out of the ordinary. It's just a certain person, a certain, you know, hijab enforcer said, you know what? I don't like this one. This is a problem. And yet there are other places in Tehran where you can walk showing your hair a lot more than Mahsa Amini was, and no one will say anything to you. Like, it's the precarity that makes it a problem. Because a lot of people that I know personally come and go a lot from Iran. No problem, no issues. But what do? Their Instagram is private. Their Facebooks are private. Before they even go to Iran, they shut down all of their social media, so you can't even see them online. I mean, these are things that you do because you're afraid, right, when you step foot somewhere. A lot of people say, why don't you go to Iran to me? I mean, are you kidding me? There's no way I would go. Not because I think I'm on their, you know, list of like people to nab. It's because I don't know what might happen at this point, right? I did go back in 1999, but after I came back from that trip, I would never dare go now because I've written about the government, et cetera, et cetera. And they love dual nationals. We are used as little pawns in their hostage diplomacy. So it's the precarity that stays with people, I think. You never know what's going to happen.
That would only add to the terror, the randomness of it. I take your point that this is not some all-seeing eye of Sauron that will punish every infraction, but that makes it no less terrifying.
But there's one other point worth mentioning, which is that this kind of terror isn't exclusively happening in Iran. And when you say things have gotten worse, one of the ways in which they've gotten worse is that Iran, you know, for much of the 80s and maybe up until the mid-90s, used to carry out extraterritorial killings. That stopped for a while. It has resumed that policy now. So in the past few years, it has kidnapped people off foreign soil, or its plots to do so have been foiled. So for example, there's a very famous women's rights activist based in New York. The FBI revealed that she was going to be kidnapped and taken back to Iran. There have been similar plots against Iranian Canadians living here. So there's always that fear that it's not even just your family back in Iran, or it's not you traveling to Iran. Bad things could happen to you in this country.
I want to return to something that you said, Samir, which is that the diaspora is not that different than other diasporas. It sounds pretty specific, actually, in some ways, as I'm just getting familiar with it. But there are definitely some things that I connect to and feel familiar to me. And I've had conversations with other people, colleagues and friends, who are sharing, I think, the same basket of anxieties right now, simultaneously being afraid for friends and family overseas in a country that has been attacked and maybe drawn into further military conflict, while worrying about their well-being, worrying about what this conflict is going to mean for our communities here. We've seen a rise in anti-Semitic violence and intimidation, Islamophobic violence and intimidation, and I have to imagine that the Iranian diaspora is on tenterhooks. If Iran becomes a bigger player in this conflict, what is that going to mean for Iranians around the world? And then simultaneously, and I extend, you know, benefit of the doubt to pretty much everybody until they prove otherwise, that everybody is traumatized by just the sheer death count of innocents in these conflicts and the suffering of hostages, the suffering of Gazans. You know, to be kind of suffering from all of those things at the exact same time seems to be something that is a common thread where I can relate to Palestinian Canadians, Jewish Canadians, Lebanese Canadians, and I suppose now Iranian Canadians.
Everyone's on edge. Like, you know, particularly when you see two governments that are willing to bomb one another, use proxies all over the world to target one another. It's a shitty time. It's a shitty time to be from the region, I think, more than any other time. I lament the fact that people who are from either, you know, in the Jewish diaspora or Iranian diaspora get targeted because of what their governments do, right? We are not our governments. And I think that that is important. When we first moved to Canada in 1979 with my parents, my sister, cousins, and I were taken hostage. We were tied up to the back of our apartment building in North York because the Iranian government had taken Americans hostage. After school, the grade six boys in our school tied us up to the back of the building and kept saying, "You took them hostage, we're going to take you hostage." And that has always stayed with me. The fact that, you know, you can be so far removed and try and get away from a government that you disdain, but the actions of that government will always reflect badly upon you. It doesn't matter what you do. People will see you as your government. And I think that that's a huge problem. And it's happening a lot now.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking to my Jewish friends, they are not happy. They are not happy that what Israel does reflects on them I think that that's a big problem. We saw it again when 9/11 happened. Muslims were targeted, systemically targeted.
Yes.
And imprisoned. And it's a problem. It's not going to go away.
I want to conclude by talking about something that Amir actually brought up when I had a conversation with him about the possibility of having this conversation. And I think you mentioned something, Amir, about being less involved in diaspora politics and sort of leaving these things behind. It reminded me of something that Latvian Jewish Canadian novelist David Bezmozgis wrote in the Globe and Mail shortly after October 7th. I'm going to read this. It'll take me a minute here. We fear each other, not the authorities. We've done it to ourselves. We have fled autocracies, dictatorships, and failed states to seek the safety of liberal democracies, where many different kinds of people are supposed to adopt democratic values and live together in peace. But when there is conflict far away, we behave as if we are there and not here. We replicate the hostility from hostile lands as if there is no other option. Yet we still live each day in another Canadian reality. I guess what I want to ask you is, just speaking personally, I've always felt a commonality amongst other grandchildren of immigrants or children of immigrants. I felt that we have more in common with each other than we have differences. What do I mean? My dad grew up in Winnipeg. He grew up in a neighborhood where Jews came to flee oppression in Europe, often from Ukrainians. So where do they choose to live in Winnipeg? They lived in the North End, a neighborhood that they shared with Ukrainians, who were also there because they were fleeing bad circumstances in Europe. And those communities pretty much got along okay. So the Canadian ideal, and I am talking about an ideal here, you know, something to aspire to, not necessarily the reality, but that Canadian ideal, as I've always understood it, is that when you come here, you leave old world conflicts behind so that we can live together peacefully in Canada. My question is that ideal dissolving?
Well, what a question. And what a beautiful quote you read out. Thank you for that. I don't think I would characterize it as dissolving because that would presuppose that it was there. I don't know that it's ever been there. I answer your question now being a couple things. Number one, an atheist. Number two, a citizen of Canada, the US, and Iran. And number three, somebody who views the world through really the lens of law, human rights law. And I find it unacceptable at any of those three levels to make it a centerpiece of our public life, what goes on in Israel, Palestine, or Iran as we sit here in Canada. I just don't think that's the centerpiece of our life. It shouldn't be. It's become so because of very strongly held feelings among members of all those communities and their proxies, Jews in Canada's proxies for Israel, if they appoint themselves such, Arabs in Canada's proxies for Palestine, if they appoint themselves such. It leads me to a place where I'm resentful, to be honest. I'm just quite resentful as a Canadian that these ethnic, religious identities imported from across the ocean consume so much of our public life and time.
Kaveh, as we were settling in, you and Samira informed me that prior to this conversation, you've just been having an argument on Twitter, which I'm no stranger to those arguments myself. One of the reasons why we're here is because I've just been noting a lot of Iranian Canadians that I know and follow on Twitter fighting with each other, deputizing themselves perhaps as proxies for conflicts around the world. And whatever kind of commonality or even just manners or civility seems to be disappearing in that conversation, the exact same as it's disappearing from pretty much every conversation I'm witnessing. What do you think about what Amir just said?
I don't know what it means to say that people are deputizing themselves to represent some other point of view. I mean, I can't speak for others. I'll just speak for myself. I am very involved in the human rights movement in Iran. But I don't think it's necessarily because I value my Iranian identity more than my Canadian one. I've spent most of my life living in this country. I see myself engaged in a battle for liberal democratic values globally. And I think where I can probably have the most impact is in my country of birth, where I speak the language, and where liberal democratic values have not taken hold because of a brutal theocratic regime. Does that mean that I'm sort of bringing old hatreds in the old country here? I don't think so. Like I said, I mean, I'm engaged in this global battle. And increasingly, I think the issue that I care about, liberal democratic values here in the West, is intersecting with the issues that I care about with respect to Iran. So just coming into this podcast studio today, from the library, I picked up Salman Rushdie's book, a new book about him getting stabbed. I think the Salman Rushdie case is a perfect example of, I want to live in a West where writers can write their points of view without having to live in hiding for decades and without getting stabbed at a literary festival. But Iran's regime, the regime that I'm fighting, is making that impossible here. So the fact that I'm engaged in that fight, I don't think it's bringing old hatreds or old acrimony to this country. I think it's just part of a global battle that we're having.
It's a contemporary battle. These are contemporary hatreds.
Absolutely.
Samira?
You know, I actually found what Amir said really interesting, because one of the things that I've noticed, particularly among the Iranian community, and I could only speak for the Iranian community, is that their politics in Canada is based on their politics vis-a-vis the Iranian government, meaning that they will vote based on who is hardest on the Iranian government, to the detriment sometimes of the country that they're actually living in. That to me is something that I think, I think it's a problem.
Isn't that a good proxy or indicator of one's values on other issues, a politician's values on other issues?
Hell no.
I don't think so. I think that it actually is a problem when you live somewhere, but your politics are somewhere else, and you don't actually care how your politics are impacting the other people that you live among in your host country, in the country that gave you refuge. I think that's a huge problem.
Amir, Samira, and Kaveh, this has been fascinating, and I really appreciate having this conversation with the three of you. Thank you.
Thanks, Jesse.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
That's your Canada Land. I hope you liked it. Listen, if you have ever wanted to make a podcast, or if you do make a podcast, or if you're an audio journalist or an audio artist, or I don't know, if you've ever heard a podcast and thought, maybe I could do that, I want to remind you that we have our first ever audio contest open. The deadline is May 31st. We're looking for 3-minute pieces about where you live. You'll find the details for this at canadaland.com/audio contest. There are cash prizes, and we will play your work to an audience of thousands and thousands of people. And this is also a way that we are going to meet a lot of aspiring audio producers. Check this out. Tell a friend, canadaland.com/audio contest. If you value this podcast or anything that our network publishes, we need your support. We rely on listeners like you paying for journalism. As a supporter, you are going to get premium access to all of our shows ad-free, including early releases and bonus content. You'll also get our exclusive newsletter, discounts on our merchandise, invites, and tickets to our live and virtual events. More than anything, you'll be a part of the solution to Canada's journalism crisis. You will be keeping our work free and accessible to everyone. Come join us now. Click on the link in your show notes or go to canadaland.com/join. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read every email that you send. Our website is canadaland.com. You can sign up for our newsletter there. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Andre Pru is our production manager. Karen Pugliese is our editor-in-chief. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. You can listen to Canada Land ad-free on Amazon Music, which is included with Prime. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures. And it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloane Stephens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloane.